And the first matter we have on today, first of all, let me see, do we have Las Vegas? There's Justice Herndon. He'll be participating from Las Vegas. So the first matter we've got on this afternoon is ADKT 595, creation of committee to study the rules governing alternative dispute resolution and short trials. So I think this was this was a matter that we created, and Justice Hardesty chaired this committee, and I believe the report has been submitted. So Jim, do you want to say a few words?
Yes, I'll. We have speakers on this topic, so I don't want to take up a lot of time. I have provided my report to the court in accordance with the assignment that was given to me and to the committee. I would just like to emphasize a couple of points. First, I want to mention to the court and to those who are participating in this proceeding that the committee devoted extensive time in meeting on this matter and in an attempt to debate and reconcile potential changes to these rules. And I want to express on behalf of the court my appreciation to each of the committee members for their participation. The process collaboratively produced some really good suggestions that went a little bit further than just the edits that had been originally discussed in the first round of hearings. And two issues in particular that I thought were of note. The first is that the committee is recommending that the court consider rules providing for a limited number of continuing legal education credits to short trial judges who serve on these cases. Many of the cases are, as we all know, reduced in amount. I don't want to diminish their importance, but reduced in amount, of course. But that results sometimes in short trial judges only getting paid by one party, not by both, or in some instances by neither. And we felt it important to consider giving some credit to a short trial judge who is in that situation and getting CLE credits for it. Conducting a jury trial is a pretty educational experience. So, and I want to thank Judge Simons, the chair of the CLE committee, for reacting as quickly as she and the board did in supporting this suggestion. If the court agrees, we'd have to implement this, but I want to thank her and the board for acting on this so quickly, as well as the Access to Justice Commission, who, as staff, also looked at this. The second thing is that the rules, with one exception, as I mentioned, was a 5-3 vote that had to do with whether you go to a two-day short trial. The committee did not resolve any questions surrounding whether there would be an increase in fees paid to short trial judges, expert witnesses, or the recovery of attorney's fees. I advised the committee early on in that process that this was a business decision that would have to be made ultimately by the court. And the court was fully familiar with the letters that had been received by the defense bar expressing reservations or objections to any fee changes in those areas. We have those letters and that input. Aside from those comments or those objections, then I think the rules come to the court with those unanimous recommendations of the committee.
Okay.
So I think we probably just want to hear, Chief, from those who want to comment on the ADR and short trial rules. If I've missed something, I express my apologies. I did want to offer one other thing. The committee noted in its report the importance of expanding courtroom space to accommodate short trials. I have had a conversation with the chief of the 8th Judicial District Court, new chief, Judge Weiss, who is investigating that matter with the two commissioners in Clark County and looking at what steps can or have been or will be taken to try to accommodate more jury space, or courtroom space, I should say, to deal with short trials in the 8th District. The other districts seem to be moving along pretty much okay based on their scheduling. So that's it. I'm sorry.
Okay, very good. Elizabeth has provided me a list of people who wanted to provide comments on this matter. And I've got several here in Las Vegas on ADKT 595. It's indicated Allison Brazier or Justin Wilson, Paul Mattioni, George Bocchanis, Graham Galloway, and David Simpson wanted to provide comments. So let me start in Carson City. So if you wanted to come up and provide comments, let's go ahead. Anybody in Carson?
Members of the court, good afternoon. Graham Galloway, appearing individually just as a old plaintiff's lawyer. I wasn't prepared to go first, but I'll go first. I have three comments. Two of them arise from problems in recent cases. And the first has to do with the length of trial. Justice Hardesty just talked about that. I represented a mother and daughter in a situation where I had to have 8 witnesses. Fortunately, on the eve of trial, the defense gave up their liability argument, so I only had to do 4 witnesses that day. But if they had not given up their argument on liability, it would have been impossible for me to put 8 witnesses on to fully flesh out the case. So I'm a strong advocate of there being a process or some mechanism where individuals, if they have the proper showing, can obtain additional time and carry it over into a second day. I'm not asking that it be done in every case. Something has to be special about it. But the number of witnesses, I think, certainly is a criteria or a factor that should be considered. The second item has to do with attorney's fees. I understand the committee has recommended that the cap on attorney's fees be eliminated, and I would be an advocate on behalf of that. I think that is proper. But in the event that the court doesn't deem that to be proper and that you all leave some form of a cap in place, one little area or a problem arose in a case just 2 months ago where I represented 2 family members in an arbitration. We prevailed at arbitration, and when we sought attorney's fees, I asked for $3,000 per plaintiff, per the rule, and the defendant objected. The arbitrator found in favor of the defendant, and the arbitration judge in Washoe County ruled against me and said that the $3,000 in the arbitration program only applied per case, not per person. NAR 16E just says $3,000. It doesn't address the issue of per person or per case. The arbitrator and the arbitration judge both referred me back to 16B, which talks about the $50,000 cap. And in that rule or that subsection, there is the per person language. So that's a disconnect, or that's a situation that doesn't make sense, because individuals would be entitled to $3,000 in fees. If there are more than one plaintiff, if they brought individual cases, they'd be entitled to $3,000 in fees. But under the arbitration judge's recent ruling against my clients, if you consolidate 2 cases like we did for judicial economy, save costs, you're not entitled to $3,000 in fees. You just get a prorated amount. So that would be something that, if you all leave a cap in place, that I would ask that you address. The third item has to do with the
go ahead and finish.
All right, thank you. It's a quick one. The $500 cap for expert fees in the short trial program. What I saw on the committee's recommendation yesterday, I saw on the website, it eliminates the $500 cap in STR 19E, But then when I went down further and looked at STR 27B5, that 500 cap appears again. So that I would be an advocate or in favor of eliminating the 500 cap when experts in both rules. That's all the comments I have, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
All right. Any questions? Thank you. And then anyone else in Carson City want to speak? Paul? Okay. Bob?
Good afternoon, members of the court. Bob Jensen with Galloway and Jensen, and I appear in this capacity on behalf of the Nevada Justice Association as part of the committee, and I'll make my comments very brief. There's been a lot of documentation submitted. One of the most critical rule changes, I think, in this, which is unanimous, is to fold in the voir dire into the total time to present the case. And I hope that goes through. I hope the court understands the importance of that. I see it as an alignment of the short trial rules with the case law in this state, because from a practical standpoint, it's extremely difficult to conduct an effective voir dire in the time that's currently allotted. The second thing is the attorney's fees, and I'd like to just address that briefly. Under the short trial rules, it's capped at $3,000. In the arbitration rules, it's capped at $3,000. I'm a vigorous proponent of uncapping the attorney's fees award for the short trial rules because this is a full-blown jury trial. It requires an extensive amount of work to prepare, just like it would a 2-3-day trial. You've got the same issues involved. If the court decides that they would like to not completely uncap the arbitration rules, then my suggestion would be to bring it current to today's standards. So we would increase the allowable recoverable attorney's fees to, say, $10,000 or $15,000. The critical issue, if there is a cap on the fees, is what my colleague, Mr. Galloway, said. As soon as that cap comes into place, then there needs to be a mechanism so that if there's multiple plaintiffs, that they can each recover. Next to the last thing I'd like to discuss is Justice Hardesty was a big proponent, I think, and I don't want to necessarily speak for him, to make it mandatory that the arbitrators issue a written decision of what their findings are, because that's not always happening, and that's critically important. So we can take it back to our clients and explain what the reasoning was, and it gives us a lot more leverage to be able to talk to our clients and discuss in a fruitful fashion whether the case should settle. The last thing is a little more controversial, and that's creating a release valve, so to speak, a mechanism to expand this out to potentially 2 days. And the thought process there was that there will be occasional cases. This is not designed to, I drafted the rule and I drafted actually a drafter's note in conjunction with that. This is not a mechanism to allow this to swallow the whole program and extend everything out to 2 days. It is really just a matter of extending it out in certain circumstances. The assigned judge will be deciding that. So if they're going to take probably a very critical view of that, because that's adding to their caseload. And for fiscal reasons, we also wanted it to go to the district court so that they can make a determination and really decide on a logistical basis, is this something that can be tried in 1 day, or do we need maybe another couple hours or 3 hours in a second day? And maybe it takes a full 2 days, because $50,000, as you all know, to most Nevadans is a lot of money. And we shouldn't be trying to pound a square peg into a round hole. If in those unusual circumstances, the district court judge should have the option to say this case should go 2 days, or we'll allow another day, and if it's another hour or two or three, fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. I'm Lynn Simons, and good afternoon. In the South, and the Chief Justice, I'm here with two hats on for judicial economy, I suppose. One is as the board chair of the Continuing Legal Education Board, and second is as the Chief Judge of the Second Judicial District. I wanted to just add a bit to my letter, saying that the board as a policy really embraces looking for new opportunities to provide CLE credits for various activities, recognizing the challenges that many lawyers face getting their CLE while practicing and being busy, and certainly for those that give their time to our court, which is deeply appreciated, particularly in the arbitration and short trial program. It's valuable. All the judges appreciate it. We do have a courtroom that we utilize for this. It sometimes is shared by other activities such as specialty court, but right now it is not, and we easily accommodate those trials. The question that we have that I think we would look for further guidance, and thank you for establishing this committee to study these rules, is the number of credits. In other programs, we've done one credit for uncompensated time. And I think the clarity that would be good here is if it's required to be, if it's an informer pauperis party, or whether it's the short trial judge decides to forego compensation without, even if they do have a client that can, or the other side can pay, and then what that number is, and whether or not it's for time, sitting as a judge, preparation, etc. We want to make sure that if these are granted, it's in accordance with what the committee wishes. But from a philosophical and policy view, the board is 100% behind it. I did survey all of our members and received all of their comments before providing my letter. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge, members of the court. I'm Paul Mattioni. Among the various hats I wear, I sat on the commission, and initially I want to thank Justice Hardesty and all the members of the committee, particularly Bob Jensen and his group. Justice Hardesty, as always, does an excellent job herding cats, and we did put in a lot of time into this. A couple of quick comments. I won't comment on the CLE portion because Judge Simons touched on it perfectly. The State Bar and the CLE Board are big advocates of trying to provide additional CLE credits. More importantly, the discussion had been about senior judge participation. And I think that can really help in expediting the backlog of these short trial issues. More importantly, a couple of issues. In the committee makeup, Justice Hardesty, and I think it's important I point this out, I'd raised it during the committee, I'm somewhat concerned with the discussion of attorney's fees. I think that everyone acknowledges there needs to be an adjustment because these original rules were written a long time ago. There was not a member of the defense bar that I can recall that sat on the committee, though I think Justice Hardesty tried to invite them to participate. So I think that there's some contrary letters in the files about how the attorney's fees should be adjusted, and I just asked the court to give that some consideration as they move forward. I thought it was important I bring that to everyone's attention. And then lastly, I think it's important when the court has their discussion to talk about the two-day issue, because not only was it a 5-2 or 5-3 vote, interestingly, it was the judges, particularly the South, I think the discovery commissioners, that had concern about the onus, particularly on their own staff, of attempting to juggle the two-day option. And while I realize it's often said this will be occasional, I've tried a few short trials in my day, and I certainly would go 2 days. And I think that most of us would say that a majority of our cases, maybe not the simplest personal injury case, but many cases are 2 days. And I think none of us want new rule to swallow the intent of the short trial program, which was to get this done in a day and be done with it. So I think that if there is a two-day option, that there really needs to be some criteria for the district court judges to evaluate whether or not this really should be moved into a two-day, while keeping in mind, particularly in the 8th Judicial, their problems with staffing, bailiffs, controlling the court, overtime, those kind of issues. So those are my only thoughts, and I thank you for allowing me to serve on the committee.
Okay, any questions for Paul? Great, thanks. All right, anybody else in Carson City want to speak on this ADKT? All right, moving to Las Vegas, I see quite a crew there. Is anybody in Las Vegas want to speak on short trial and ADR rules?
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Justin Wilson. I'm an attorney with Hicks and Brazier. In a recent short trial that I tried, opposing counsel and I jointly requested additional time outside of the 15 minutes allotted by Rule 23 of the Nevada Short Trial Rules. In that case, despite the agreement by counsel and the assurance that neither party would come close to using all of our time, the short trial judge deferred to Rule 23 and limited us to 15 minutes for voir dire. In that case, at the end of the trial, each party had around an hour and a half left. It was a more simple case, but still, the time was there. The process to seek justice should be the same, whether the value of a case is above $50,000 or below $50,000. A party seeking to gain redress before a jury of their peers should be entitled to seek full justice, even in a short trial. Determining bias is critical. Without removing bias, justice simply can't be served. And in the short trial, that phase is currently hamstrung as Rule 23 is written. I appreciate that in order to facilitate a short trial, limits must be placed on the time available to an advocate. However, the advocate should be allowed to determine the best use of their time, which would include utilizing excess time to fetter out bias with a voir dire process that is not artificially limited as it currently stands. And that's all I have, Your Honors, unless you have any questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices Allison Brazier of Hicks and Brazier. I want to talk specifically about the attorney's fee issue. As we all know, Rule 68 and offers of judgment serve a really useful purpose in driving settlement in cases that should and could be settled. But when you're talking about a cap of $3,000, offers of judgment really don't have the same effect in the ADR program as it currently stands. For most large businesses and insurance companies, $3,000 is the cost of doing business. And so it doesn't have that same effect. And we're seeing more and more trials where the arbitration really is almost just a box to check, because we know the case is going to get de novo and it's going to go to short trial again, because there's not real consequences for these big businesses and insurance companies that are on the other side of the case. I've also become aware in this community that certain in-house defense firms that are captive to certain insurance companies incentivize their attorneys to go to short trial. So they get paid $1,000 to take a case to short trial, whether they win the trial or not. So the incentive is just, let's just de novo all these cases, there's no real consequence, and there's no teeth to the offer of judgment rule, because $3,000, you know, is a drop in the bucket for most of the people that we see on the other side of our cases. The last thing I want to say is just to echo what my associate Justin said, is that, you know, we should have some fairness whether a case is worth $50,000 or $51,000 and now it's exempted. If a case is worth just a touch more, you know, the parties are able to recover their attorney's fees, but we've now placed, for whatever reason, we've placed an arbitrary cap when we hit that $50,000 ceiling in value. So I would urge the court to uncap the attorney's fees, both in the arbitration program, but more urgently in the short trial program. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices. Richard Dreitzer on behalf of the State Bar of Nevada.
The bar takes no position as far as the solutions to a lot of the problems, but commends the committee for its work in identifying what those problems are. So officially, we take no position to that respect, but we did want to identify one aspect of what Mr. Galloway touched on a moment ago, and that's with regard to the short trial rules, Rule 19 versus Rule 27. Rule 19 in the changed version references NRS 18.005, and if you refer back to that, it refers to a $1,500 figure, yet the figure specified at Rule 27 talks about $500. So it's not just the policy dispute of whether or not to have a cap, it's also the inconsistency in amount between those two rules. But that being said, that's all I wanted to offer to the court today.
Thank you, Mr. Dresser. I appreciate you pointing that out. And Mr. Galloway, I think there was an edit problem. We really struggled to get all the red lines into this, and anybody who's edited rules know that you can have a slip between the cup and the lip. I don't think that the difference that you're pointing to, although it should be pointed out, was purposeful. And it can be corrected based on the minutes of the committee. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Okay, anybody else in Las Vegas?
Hey, please the court, Sean Claggett. I'm going to touch on a couple of things. One is during COVID, we were forced to use alternative methods to try cases, one of which was to try cases in very unique locations, which included here in Las Vegas, convention centers. I've tried a case in a casino, an empty casino ballroom. I've done trials in some of the strangest of all places since COVID occurred. With budget restraints and concerns about a two-day trial, we needed to think outside the box. In Las Vegas, there are probably no less than 10 to 15 private trial settings, including my office that has a private courtroom. Gene Porter has a private courtroom. Robert Eglin has a private courtroom. Farhad Naqvi has a private courtroom. Jimmy Cogburn has one. They're becoming more and more the standard because of the amount of focus groups and mock trials that attorneys are doing to make sure that they're complying with the standard of care for a trial lawyer. I believe that there is a method and a way that we can think outside the box to allow access to having jurors utilize these courtrooms to take the burden off the current courtrooms. We did it at the convention center, and there was jurors driving around, parking in random parking lots, and it worked out candidly quite great. And so I think that tough times require people to think outside the box, and I think with the backlog of trials, I think now is the time for us all to work together to find solutions and not to continue to make excuses why it can't be done, but to find reasons that we can do it. And as I've always been saying, and many years ago, Justice Stiglitz, when she first got on the bench, we talked about the problem with not enough jury trials, and the art of being a trial lawyer is being lost. And so we need to encourage more trials, not less, and we need to find solutions and not excuses. So hopefully we can all work together to find solutions, especially here in Las Vegas, to make sure these cases are getting tried. The next issue that I want to talk about is the voir dire time. I think the Seventh Amendment is so critical to all of us. And these clients, plaintiff and defendants, wait so many years to get their day in court. And to randomly limit voir dire to 15 minutes seems unjust for all parties. And I believe that we need to allow the litigants the amount of time to have a fair and unbiased jury. The question I always ask when I go around the country and try cases to the judge is, how many biased jurors should we sit? And the judges oftentimes look at me with a strange look and say, of course, none. And I go, great, what's the solution to make sure that happens? And it's a full and complete voir dire. So I believe that the recommendation is excellent to rid of the arbitrary limitation on voir dire, as I think that that is not just, and I think it actually is unconstitutional. Lastly, when it comes to the attorney's fees, I agree that it makes no sense. And if we're trying to encourage folks to stay within the short trial program, one of the benefits of moving outside the short trial program is you're automatically entitled to the benefits of NRS 18.010. in Rule 68, but if you stay within the short trial program, you're excluded from those benefits. And so if we want to encourage folks to stay within the program, I would encourage that we remove the cap and make it consistent across the board. It would also prevent what I've been seeing as an arbitrator. I don't necessarily handle these type of cases, in my own practice, but I do sit as an arbitrator and as a short trial judge, and I do notice that the lack of work that I see being done and the lack of attention to these cases in the arbitration program is disturbing. But I also know that there's a fact that my friends and colleagues on the defense have been placed in an untenable position of being flat-feed by many of these multi-billion dollar insurance companies. And so there really is no incentive to actually do the work anymore. And so we end up having this process, as Ms. Brazier explained, is pro forma. It's just checking a box. And it doesn't feel good for me to waste my time as an arbitrator when I know that the response, no matter what the resolution I give and the time that I put into the case, is simply to de novo. And so I believe there needs to be some behavior modification, which I believe enforcing NRS 18.010 and Rule 68 in the short trial and in the arbitration program, I think will can achieve that. There's no questions. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Justices, my name is Jay Young. I'm Discovery Commissioner in the 8th Judicial District Court. Also one of the committee members, and I do appreciate Justice Hardesty as well as all the members of the committee for the collaborative nature of our deliberations, and really appreciate the hard work that they put into it. I do want to address a couple of issues. The first, which is the issue of the cap on attorney's fees. We presently have a system where if a litigant goes to justice court, there is no cap on their attorney's fees award. If they go to district court, there is no cap. But we have a strange situation where if they're subject to arbitration, not only is there a cap on their attorney's fees, but they have to pay for the pleasure of having their jurist make a decision, whereas they have no payment obligation if they're in justice court or in district court. So I think that there is an access to justice issue here where we are penalizing those who, for no fault of their own, happen to have a dispute that falls in that short window between $15,000 and the $50,000 amount. I also believe that putting no cap on attorney's fees encourages full participation in the arbitration program, which I've seen as an arbitrator and as discovery and ADR commissioner is a problem. And we have no clear rules regarding what constitutes good faith participation in the process. So having no cap exposes all parties to a risk that they don't have exposure to right now, as Mr. Claggett has indicated. If that cap is at $3,000, then there's really no risk to a large corporation, as Ms. Brazier indicated. So I believe that exposing all parties to that equal risk, that if they take an unreasonable position, whether they're a plaintiff or defendant, if they take an unreasonable position, they're exposed to greater amount of attorney's fees. The last thing that I would like to address is the courtroom utilization issue in the 8th Judicial District Court. I think that there's a misunderstanding. There is no backlog in our short trial program. There has not been a backlog in our short trial program since mid-2021. In fact, in 2021, we tried more cases in the short trial program than the rest of the district court combined in the 8th Judicial District Court. The issue there was the concern that if we went to a two-day short trial program, that and it's true that we scramble every week to find a courtroom to hold our short trial jury trials. But we have a cooperative panel of judges and their staff who graciously allow us to use their courtrooms. The concern was if we went to 2 days, whether we would be able to use a courtroom for 2 days in a row. The way that the rule is presently proposed, that would take place in the district court, not with a short trial judge. If the district court allows the 2 days, they control their own courtroom, so we would not have that scramble. Thank you. Unless there are any questions.
Commissioner, this is Justice Hardesty. During the period that I was chief in 2021, I reached out to a number of firms in the Las Vegas area asking them to make available their facilities to conduct trials. Short trials seem to be trials that would be conducive to that. Is this something that would fit within the scheduling of the short trial program to reach out and utilize those courtrooms in order to get some of those trials moving along? I have a different memory of the committee's discussion on this issue. My memory is, and the minutes reflect, that the only trials held are on Fridays in the 8th District.
Correct.
And that you and your colleague on the commission voted in opposite directions on this problem.
That's also correct.
Yeah. So well, the definition of a backlog is always an interesting and tricky thing to talk about. The fact of the matter is access to justice requires, in my view, access to facilities to get these trials heard. And I just wondered if the 8th District is open to a plan that would avail themselves of courtrooms outside the courthouse in order to accomplish that.
Well, let me see if I can be more clear, Your Honor. Justice Hardesty, we presently do not lack for courtroom space for the number of short trials that are coming through our system. We presently have zero backlog. We have the number of courtrooms available on Fridays that we need. We have not had a problem with that since the time that I've been commissioner. We did have a short backlog during COVID. We pushed through that in mid-2021. With regard to the offer from members of the bar to hold short trials at their facilities, I think that is both generous and it is an offer that we would take them up on. I think it's appropriate if we have a bench trial. My concern is how we get jury services to get jurors to and from those remote locations. And so I don't know that it exactly works for a jury trial, but it certainly works for a bench trial.
Okay, thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Justices.
Thank you. All right, anybody else in Las Vegas?
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Erin Truman, and I am the ADR Discovery Commissioner, one of the two ADR Discovery Commissioners in the 8th Judicial District Court. I just wanted to point out one thing that I think may go overlooked, and I want to make sure does not go overlooked, that there's been a lot of discussion regarding a two-day trial, and currently the rules do allow for cases where there is a situation where an attorney believes that the case should not be tried under the short trial rules, which only allow for one day, for it to be removed from short trial. And that is Nevada Short Trial Rule 5, which does already allow a demand out provision where if you don't believe your case can be tried within one day, you can remove it from the program and then it will go back into the district court's docket and the district court judge will try it. And so there's already a remedy in place under the rules as they stand created to allow for a two-day short trial if that is what the attorney believes needs to happen. And so I think that it's somewhat of a misdirection to say that we need another remedy for that. At least that's the position that I've taken, is that I think that there already is a way for that to be handled under Nevada Short Trial Rule 5. And the issue, and I did want to confirm that the issue that we have in the 8th Judicial District Court is not enough courtrooms for one-day jury trials. It was the concern that we would not have the same courtroom available for a two-day jury trial to have a jury proceed in 2 days, because typically on Fridays we get courtrooms that are not in use because either cases have settled, and every week it's a juggle, but we have never had to cancel a jury trial for lack of a courtroom. And I would just echo what Commissioner Young has said about using the gracious offer from local counsel for their courtrooms. We often have bench trials that are, most of our bench trials, or at least, well, maybe not most, but a significant portion of our bench trials are held in attorneys' offices currently because there is no need for jury services to provide juries. I think that if we utilized courtrooms of in offices of attorneys in Las Vegas, the problem would be, or the difficulty would be, having jury services being able to provide jury panels to those remote locations, as indicated by Commissioner Young. And I think that was the concern that we have there. So that's all I wanted to add, unless anyone has any questions for me at this time.
No, but thank you for your service. Both you and Commissioner Young did a great job for all of us.
And I also want to thank all members of the committee. It was a great process to be a part of, and everyone worked very diligently. And thank you, Justice Hardy, for marshaling all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else in Las Vegas?
Good morning, good afternoon, rather. Chief Justice and Justices, George Bochanis, 631 South 9th Street, Las Vegas. First, I wanted to thank this court for the opportunity to be able to serve on this committee. I appreciated working with Justice Hardesty, the judges, our hardworking discovery commissioners here in the South, and the other judges and attorneys that were on this committee. I just want to talk about two issues very quickly. The first issue is the possible expansion up to 2 days to have these short trial matters heard. I guess one problem that we have with opting out of the program is that the current rules require a $1,000 payment to be made by the party that wants to opt out of the program. And an earlier speaker talked about the access to justice issue. I look at access to justice as being a financial matter for a lot of our clients who, when they're entering the short trial program, have to pay a set amount for a judge to hear their case. And likewise, for them to opt out, they'd even have to pay a higher amount to have their case taken out of the short trial program. I think the screening recommendation that was made to take a case out of the one-day limitation is a reasonable one. It allows that district court judge that who's going to hear the case to decide what factors are before him in enabling the case to be taken from the one-day limitation. I can tell you from experience that representing multiple plaintiffs with multiple treatment providers, it's very difficult to properly represent those individuals in that short of a time setting. I think perhaps the more important issue, to me at least, is the attorney fee issue. I've been an arbitrator for the mandatory arbitration program when it first started. I think there were initially 20 or 25 attorneys that were hearing these cases as arbitrators. And unfortunately, as time has gone on, we've seen a process where it's become a matter of practice almost, or part of the negotiation of a case, that an arbitration is held, not much work is done on the arbitration, and then just trial de novos are filed as a matter of course. I think that applying NRS 18010, where full attorney fees can be awarded, takes that away and stops that process and makes everyone, so not only does it benefit the short trial program, but I think it strengthens the arbitration program and it requires attorneys to take arbitration seriously. I think it's also fair to state that the cap on attorney fees doesn't adequately reflect the amount of time that attorneys spend on these. I admit that short trials aren't a major portion of my practice, but the few that I've done, a $3,000 attorney fee for the amount of time that's spent on them is hardly commensurate with the work that's being done. When it beeps more than one time, does that mean I'm supposed to shut up?
No, go ahead. Go ahead and finish.
I'll wrap up. Thank you. Thank you, Chief Justice. I think that we've come to a point where the trial de novo process has been abused, actually, knowing that their culpability on these cases is going to be maximized at a $3,000 attorney fees. It's not, first of all, it's not fair to the litigants. And secondly, it weakens, I think, the arbitration and short trial program. So we think these common sense proposed changes are meaningful and will strengthen the program. And I appreciated the opportunity to serve on this committee. And I thank you all for being able to speak to you this afternoon. If there's any questions I can answer, I'd be happy to at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else in Las Vegas? Okay, I don't see anybody else in Las Vegas. Justice Hardesty, would you like to make any concluding remarks?
I want to thank the speakers who attended today. The comments reflect a lot of the debate that the committee had on each of these points. I think the matter should stand submitted. I hope we can get this matter addressed by the court promptly and get these rules out so that they can become effective January 1 is my hope. I want to thank everybody's contributions to this effort. We've got some business decisions to make in the court. We can move this forward as soon as those are addressed. And thank you for the clarification on a couple of the points that Mr. Galloway and others mentioned.
Okay, then. This matter will stand submitted, and we will call up 80KT 599. And this was a petition sponsored by the State Bar of Nevada Board of Governors and the Board of Bar Examiners to amend SCR 51.2 related to Functional Equivalency Committee. And let's see, who have I got down south?
Chief Justice, you have Dean Gould, the admissions director for the State Bar down south, and I think Richard Trachuk, the chair of the Board of Bar Examiners, is in Carson City.
Yes, he is. Okay.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good afternoon. As I mentioned, may it please the court, I'm Dean Gould, the admissions director of the State Bar of Nevada and a member of the Board of Bar Examiners. This is the date and time scheduled by the court for public comment on ADKT 0599, which covers the proposed revisions to SCR 51.5 and Addendum 2 relating to the process for certifying functional equivalency for bar applicants who either attended law school in the United States at an unaccredited ABA law school or who attended a foreign law school outside the United States. The proposed revisions were submitted by the Board of Bar Examiners and were approved by the Board of Governors of the State Bar of Nevada. We are always trying to increase efficiencies, and in that context, we have proposed these rules for a couple reasons. Number one, we believe it will greatly increase the efficiency of this process by removing the need for all of these applicants, these functional equivalency applicants, to have to come to hearings when it's not necessarily required or needed. Much of this information can be gleaned from the papers that are submitted to us. We also want to, based on feedback we've received, we would like to expand this to two cycles per year rather than just one, and have those cycles line up with the two bar examinations in February and July. This puts a real burden on the existing committee, because this can be very time consuming for the committee. We would like to handle the functional equivalency determinations like we already handle a special accommodation decisions for applicants for the bar exam and for character and fitness matters, which fall primarily within the jurisdiction of the admissions director working with the chair of the Board of Bar Examiners, or in the case of character and fitness, the chair of the Moral Character and Fitness Committee. These proposed revisions would allow the admissions director, working with a designated member of the Board of Bar Examiners, to make these determinations. Again, many of these decisions can be made based on the papers that are submitted by the applicants. The rules and the addendum are very clear about what has to be submitted. Often they aren't submitted, and for example, we have 8 people who have applied for this cycle. 3 or 4 of them are going to be summarily rejected because they did not submit nearly any information that would give us an ability to review. But the 4 or 5 who did, we have had to go back and ask for more information, which is fine. We give them a short window in which to do that, and if they don't, then we summarily reject them. The way that we are proposing this, if the admissions director and the member of the Board of Bar Examiners don't agree on a recommendation, then the chair of the Board of Bar Examiners would make the decision. As always, if a petitioner is denied functional equivalency certification, he or she is then permitted to appeal that decision to this court. One other change that's being proposed here is that if an applicant has received an LLM degree from an American law school, which is accredited by the ABA, the applicant will be deemed to have satisfied the functional equivalency requirement. In this case, the role of our review would be to verify the degree and to verify that the school is appropriately accredited. In this case, what I would generally recommend is, but only in the case of the LLM, is that the fee which they pay, which we are proposing to increase to $1,000, would be credited to the bar exam application. We do that now with limited admissions. Someone who gets admitted to be a general counsel or something, deputy attorney general, we let them apply that to the bar exam when they take it. Thank you for your consideration of this ADKT, and I'm happy to answer any questions or if Mr. Trashok has any other comments he'd like to put forth.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions?
I do.
Okay, Justice Kadish.
Mr. Gold, good to see you this afternoon.
Thank you, Justice.
I guess you covered it, but I guess if I could put it kind of bluntly, what's the problem that we're solving by eliminating the functional equivalency committee? Has there been a difficulty in getting people on the committee or getting them to serve? Because if it's too much work for the seven people on the committee, I'm confused about how putting two people in charge of it makes it better.
Well, I think there are a couple answers to that, Justice Kadish, and it's a good question. I think first, it is the kind of analysis that the admissions director does every day with character and fitness. I have, in the last 3 days, in light of bar results coming out tomorrow, I've conducted probably 35 to 40 informal interviews for character and fitness just this week alone. We do this all the time. We're geared for it. It takes an incredible amount of staff time to prepare for these hearings. It takes an incredible amount of time for the committee members to take time away from their practices or their courtrooms, wherever they work, to attend these hearings for 2-3 days sometimes. There's an expense that goes along with having to have court reporters for all of these. So in an attempt to make this process more efficient, we at the Board of Bar Examiners decided that it would make more sense to align this more closely with how we handle character and fitness or special accommodations, where we only bring in somebody if there's a need. And frankly, I'm not sure there is a need for this. I think that this committee may have served a purpose 30, 40 years ago when it was established, but nowadays I think that with the advent of the internet and the world getting smaller, we can pretty much determine without a lot of the time and effort that the committee has to put in, we can make that decision internally.
And so the Board of Bar Examiners would select one of their members, or I guess the Board of Governors, one of their
Board of Bar Examiners, Justice.
Yeah. And so one of them would be the designated person who deals with these issues while they're the designated person?
With the admissions director, correct. Right. And then the chair of the Board of Bar Examiners would select the person from the Board of Bar Examiners to work with the admissions director to review these. So the admissions staff, under the direction of the admissions director, would work up the files like we do for accommodations, like we do for character and fitness, and then we would, in my case, I would sit down with the designated person from the Board of Bar Examiners. We would review them with the staff, make a decision. If we all agree, or if the Board of Bar Examiners designee and I would agree, then we would make that decision, write it up. If we can't agree, then the chair of the Board of Bar Examiners would sort of cast the deciding vote.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we've got Rick Trashok here in Carson City. Rick, did you want to say a couple words?
Members of the court, Rick Trachok, chair of the Board of Bar Examiners. First of all, I'd like to offer my thanks and appreciation to the chair of the Functional Equivalency Committee and all of his members. It's a ton of work, and they've been diligent, and we appreciate everything that they've done for the bar. And I do have a couple comments. I agree with what Dean said in terms of why we're trying to change this. We're trying to make this more efficient. And as the, I don't know if I should admit this, but as the lawyer that argued the case in front of the court way back when with the old college graduates that gave rise to the Functional Equivalency Committee, the situation then was completely different than what we have today. Today, we don't have new law schools coming on board that aren't accredited. You still have the unaccredited law schools in California, have a couple in Florida, and I think one still exists in Arizona, but all of these have already been vetted a number of times over the last 30 years. In terms of the foreign law schools, it's pretty simple. If you, most European law schools, most Asian law schools, the law degree is an undergraduate degree. It's the UK is also an undergraduate degree, but in the UK they then go on to 2 years of article clerking, or if they're going to be a barrister, they go through that clerking process. So it's pretty easy for us to take a look at the records there. There's not a lot that would come out through a hearing that wouldn't be either presented or could be available. And so we're just trying to make this more efficient use of time moving forward. And then the last piece with the LLM change there is the, you see across the country, law schools across the country, including in Boyd, that have offered different LLM programs, some of whom are attended by foreign attorneys that are seeking to get a degree in a common law jurisdiction. And it's easy to look at those programs. They're ABA accredited. We have a pretty good idea of what's being offered and the whether or not it would satisfy those requirements of the ABA law school. So I'm happy to answer any questions. Those are all the comments I have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Nope. Okay, thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Anybody else in Las Vegas? Anybody else in Carson City?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the court. For the record, Jeff Rodefer, I am the current chair of the Functional Equivalency Committee, and I have been a member of the committee since it was created in 1993, and it has been an extreme honor to serve on the committee. The members of the committee asked me to be present today. There's a lot of mixed emotion on this change in the rule. We have all spent an enormous amount of time, as Mr. Trachok has indicated, in preparing for hearings and doing hearings and writing decisions, traveling, et cetera. But as Mr. Trachok has indicated, the role of the Functional Equivalency Committee has changed a little bit. In the early years, we largely only heard petitions from unaccredited law schools here in this country. And we would hold upwards of 3 or 4 days of hearings every year. As time has gone by, we largely now only hear from foreign law schools. And so I wanted to, with the court's indulgence, I just wanted to point out a couple of areas maybe in the rule for your consideration as you deliberate on this. The first area is under Rule 51.5, subsection 1A, subsection 2, which talks about being engaged in a full-time practice of law for 10 of the preceding 12 years. Now, this is an area that the committee has struggled with over the years, and there's some other areas that the committee has struggled with, and we have always taken the position of trying to be liberal in our application of the rule to try to meet the intent of the court, which, as it's set forth in the Amendola case and in other cases, we should not apply the rules in a manner that would otherwise keep a qualified applicant out of being a lawyer here in the state of Nevada. But this particular rule, as the committee has noted over the years, is probably arbitrarily long. There are other jurisdictions, including Pennsylvania most recently, who adopted a rule which is 5 years of full-time engagement in the practice of law over the preceding 8 years. So that may be an area that the court wants to address. And where the committee has seen issues with this rule has been not so much for lawyers who are obviously licensed to practice, for say, in California and are continuing to practice in California, but it's for those lawyers that got licensed in another jurisdiction and then come to the state of Nevada and are working remotely, or maybe they're working as a law clerk or paralegal for some firm, and they're making the argument that, well, I've got 5 years or 6 years or 7 years, but you know, I'm really, here's what I'm doing as a paralegal, and they go right up against what we would consider the barrier for being a practicing lawyer here in the state. The second area, and it concerns that same subsection 1A2, and we saw it most recently in Pennsylvania, where they limited that rule to say very clearly that your practice is in the jurisdiction in which you are licensed or permitted to practice law. We have seen, as I just indicated, some people actually come to the state of Nevada and engage in various activities such as paralegals, law clerks, whatever, and they want that activity to be construed as the practice of law. The other area that I think the court may want to consider, which is subsection 1A3, which talks about augmentation. Currently, there's no list in the rule regarding augmentation. It's an area that we struggle in trying to pull the information out of the petitioners as they come before us. It may behoove the court to put a non-inclusive list of what criteria qualifies as augmentation, or simply reference the N. Ray Amendola decision. And then with regard to finding a functional equivalency, you may find it, as some jurisdictions have done, find it easier to limit, especially for foreign law schools, jurisdictions where the jurisprudence in that jurisdiction is based upon common law. As you've probably seen in our decisions over the years, we've always included a provision or a paragraph that was drafted a long time ago by our original chair, Mr. Tom Beatty, who unfortunately passed away. But he drafted a provision that sort of sets forth, I think fairly eloquently, how the committee has addressed these foreign applicants. And for the court's indulgence, I will read it. The committee has frequently observed that in one sense, no education provided by a foreign law school can be truly characterized as the functional equivalent of an education at an ABA-approved law school. Nevertheless, there may be, in some instances, based upon particular experiences and background of the individual petitioner, sufficient common elements between the education received and the experience gained in the foreign country, and that offered at an ABA-accredited institution, that they may be roughly the functional equivalent of one another. And the court has attempted to evaluate the facts presented by the petitioner in this light. And that is what we have always tried to do. The next provision, which is a new provision that Mr. Gould just addressed, which is subsection 1D, which is a petitioner having an LLM from an ABA-accredited institution. And I'll simply make this comment to the court. We have noticed over the years a lot of petitioners have come forward with LLM degrees. Some of them are in specific areas such as taxation or now at UNLV, the Gaming Law and Regulation Program. But there are a significant number of law schools out there that actually cater to students from foreign countries by basically allowing them to get an LLM by repeating first-year courses at an ABA-accredited institution. We have seen in many of those instances There is no requirement that the student actually attend class. They can do it remotely or however they want to do it, but it doesn't comport with ABA accreditation standard 308. And so the committee has struggled with that, but in most instances, the committee has recognized an LLM from an ABA accredited institution. One additional area, actually two additional areas, is subsection 3, which is the petition is deemed complete when it is filed by the date set forth in the rule. I think the committee would recommend to the court, as Dean has talked about too, the ongoing issue in trying to get all the documentation from these petitioners, and it has been a struggle over the years, that maybe that particular rule should be further clarified to state that the petition is deemed complete when it is timely filed, and such filing includes the documentation that is required by addendum 2 in the rule. And then specifically looking at addendum 2, subsection 4, the court may want to consider actually amending that list to require transcripts or evidence of augmentation or other information that is typically required on the bar application, such as whether or not the applicant has been subject to academic probation, whether or not they were subject to disciplinary action in another jurisdiction, setting forth their litigation, credit history, employment history. And with that, I am happy to answer any questions, Your Honors. If this is the end of the Functional Equivalency Committee, then I would just want to state again, it has been a true honor to have served on the committee over the past almost 30 years. I was a member from 1993 to 2003, and then a vice chair from 2003 until 2019, when Mr. Beatty contacted me and said his health would no longer allow him to continue, and then I became chair in 2019. Thank you very much.
I commend your service, and I thank you for it. But before you make a clean getaway,
okay.
Respectfully, I would appreciate it if you wouldn't mind writing a little letter summarizing what you just put in here.
Okay.
There are a number of items you've highlighted where I think choices need to be made, and I don't feel comfortable making some of those word choices just yet. So it'd be helpful to have that and your recommendations as to how you might deal with it. I had never even considered the idea that not all LLMs are equal.
Right.
Apparently they're not.
Yeah, they're not equally
created. That's quite an interesting turn of events, quite frankly. And as well, the issue about augmentation, I don't know about referencing just to Amendola solves the problem. It may, but I don't know that it does. So it would be food for thought to have a letter that summarizes this. We can obviously listen to this tape, but it would really be beneficial to also get suggested word language that could be considered by the court. That's my view.
Okay. I will draft something up, and I'll circulate it to the committee members if they want to add anything to it.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, and really appreciate your service.
Well, somebody reminded me the other day that when my current time as chair of the gaming law section is done, I will have served on sections or committees for the state bar a total of 54 years, which I hadn't really fully comprehended at the time. So,
remarkable.
I don't know if that qualifies as pro bono or CLE credits or anything like that.
Certainly service to the profession. So
certainly service to the profession. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any other comments on this matter? Okay, hearing none, we will conclude this public hearing. These matters will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until the next call of the court.